From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Roaches, rats, bedbugs, and other people-loving pests have been with us for centuries, and despite our best efforts, they persist. That's particularly true in cities, especially in neighborhoods with a history of disinvestment. UMBC professor Dawn Beeler is an expert on the history of the urban war on pests. She's the author of Pests in the City: Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches, and Rats. And she recently found that mosquitoes in Baltimore tend to cluster in certain areas.
Those neighborhoods that have that history of disinvestment and lots of vacant lots have about three times as many of a particular kind of mosquito as the neighborhood that has no history of disinvestment.
Pests, living symbols of our long battle with inequality. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Today we're talking about perhaps the most unwelcome inhabitants of our homes and yards: roaches, rats, and other people-loving pests. We've been battling them as a society for a long time, but they persist, particularly in cities. My guest is an expert on the history of the urban war on pests. Dawn Beeler is an associate professor of geography and environmental systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and she's the author of Pests in the City: Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches, and Rats. And she's here with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you, Sheila.
In your book, you cover the handling of pest infestations in major cities in the United States over the course of the 20th century. Why did you choose that as a starting point?
Well, just personally, I grew up on a farm and was very interested in how my family defined welcome versus unwelcome animals in that environment. And then I moved to a big city and was working in affordable housing issues and became interested in the ways housing can be healthy or unhealthy for people who live there. And so this interest in animals and the way we categorize them intersected with my interest in healthy housing. And we just kind of went from there.
How much progress have we made since the dawn of the 20th century?
I think we're doing better in general. We no longer have streets lined with manure from our horse-drawn vehicles, so we no longer have the flies that we had at the beginning of the 20th century. We managed to wipe out bed bugs almost in the middle of the 20th century, though they've come back pretty well. I would guess, we don't have great numbers from the early 20th century, but my best guess is that we do have fewer rats today than we did back then. But these creatures are very tenacious. They've come back again and again, and some of the things we do actually make them tougher, such as the pesticides that we have applied.
And you didn't mention cockroaches. I've always had the impression that they're considered the most indestructible.
Yes. And so things that we've done with our homes have actually made our homes better for cockroaches, from the way that we build the kind of guts of our buildings, where cockroaches are able to move from one apartment to another on the utility lines that run between two apartments. Any source of water is a great thing for cockroaches. They need a kind of moist environment. And if we eat our food in places other than the dining room, we're just opening up more places where they might be gathering crumbs. So yeah, we've done a lot of things. That tendency to like eat in front of the TV or bring food into your bedroom, those tend to spread cockroaches as well.
A lot of your work has to do with the links among urban pests, housing inequality, and public health. Give us a sense of how those three things fit together.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm most interested in how housing for low-income people or people kind of on the margins of society has facilitated infestation by these different kinds of pests. And I guess what I would say is, throughout the 20th century up through today, there have been attempts by progressive governments to try to ensure the quality of housing for people with low incomes. And most of those efforts have been underfunded. And so if we go back to the 1930s, when public housing in the United States got its start, there were really high ideals. And among those ideals was making sure that people didn't have to live with some of these pests. But there was just never the money invested in those buildings to make them really sound and healthy and to support the kind of community environmental management systems that would have kept pests out of those buildings. So we've never, I think, really invested in making our cities sound and healthy places for the people who can least afford housing.
Is the poorest quality housing then no better off in terms of pests than it was decades ago?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think in many cities we have housing courts where we take landlords to court in order to make them enforce housing codes more. One thing that is measurably better is that we no longer have legal racial segregation. And that was one of the biggest problems because it created a two-tiered housing system where basically Black residents of cities such as New York City and Baltimore didn't have the full range of choices that white residents did. And that gave their landlords who were willing to rent to African Americans, gave the landlords license to let those buildings run down and become very poor in quality and therefore very permeable to these kinds of pests. And we have better anti-segregation laws now. The legacy of segregation persists and, in fact, continues to create a lot of problems with infestation. But that's one thing where we do have some legal protections. It hasn't provided full protection, but I would say that's one of the reasons why African American communities often suffer very high rates of infestation.
Well, when you spoke a few minutes ago about efforts by essentially, I think, public health entities and agencies to address pest infestation, those efforts didn't deal with redlining or other forms of housing segregation, did they?
Well, they, in many cases, perpetuated racial segregation. For example, Chicago is a very dramatic case of this. In Chicago, when the public housing buildings were built in the 1930s and 40s, there was a very strong effort among the real estate interests in that city and as well as in other cities to really limit the amount of affordable housing that was built, the amount of public housing that was built. And they kind of roused up a lot of the white citizens of Chicago to fight against having Black residents of the city located in white neighborhoods. And so it ended up being that the Chicago Housing Authority kept all of the Black public housing residents in neighborhoods that were already Black and white public housing residents in neighborhoods that were already white. And one of the legacies of this actually ties right into issues of infestation. The Henry Horner Homes public housing project was extremely infested with thousands of German cockroaches in that building. This is an African-American project in a primarily African-American neighborhood. And when investigators found that the city of Chicago and the Chicago Housing Authority had deliberately segregated Black from white residents, there were a number of legal remedies that were put into place. And one of them resulted in Henry Horner Homes being rebuilt as a pest-free complex. This was in the 1990s, actually. So the problems in Henry Horner Homes date back to segregation and the attempts to keep Black residents separate from white residents. And then the solution was actually as a result of this anti-segregation court decision that basically told the residents there, we are going to make this housing development pest-free and healthy for you.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Dawn Beeler, a professor at UMBC and an expert on household pests and how human beings have tried to control them. She's the author of Pests in the City, Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches, and Rats. One of the things you study is the stigma that comes from having pests like bedbugs in your home. Has that stigma had any bearing on our ability to control pests?
It definitely does. Stigma is a huge problem and a huge hindrance to controlling pests. And I think bedbugs are a very good case of this. When people believe that bedbugs have a stigma And that stigma can be enforced not only kind of in just feeling bad or feeling ashamed of oneself, but in actually being prevented from renting homes. It can follow you around with your housing applications, and landlords can deny you the right to live in a home, to have a home rented to you as a result of your bedbug history. So that stigma is very important. And if one perceives that you'll suffer these consequences in the future, people hide their bedbug infestation and don't tell their landlords or seek help for it. And as a result, that bedbug infestation has a tendency to spread throughout buildings. So it's actually a very good thing to make controlling bedbugs as friendly and as healthy and happy as possible for tenants of multifamily buildings. We want individuals and families to report bedbug infestations as early as possible so that we can prevent that infestation from spreading to adjacent apartments.
And there's been, I don't know whether resurgence is too strong a word, but there's more reports of more bedbug infestations. Has that reduced the stigma that's attached to a bedbug problem?
Well, I think you're perfectly right in using the word resurgence. I think it's been that dramatic that we can call it a resurgence. I think the stigma is still there, and there are efforts certainly by public health agencies and by some community organizations to reduce that stigma. There's an apartment building in Washington, D.C. that I'm very aware of, where the community kind of came together and formed a very strong alliance around getting rid of bedbugs, and they ended up purchasing that apartment building from the landlord. So there are great cases like that where bedbugs have actually brought people together, and the shared knowledge that we all have bedbugs and they've kind of spread throughout our building creates community and a kind of political action. On the other hand, there have been very terrible cases of people taking it upon themselves to get rid of their bedbugs and doing very dangerous things like spraying very flammable liquids around their house in an attempt to get rid of the bedbugs. So I think it's going both ways. The internet has actually been a big help here. There are websites like bedbugger.com and other sites where people who've experienced infestation with bedbugs share their story and get support so they can bring things out in the open in that kind of way. But at the same time, there have been policies by landlords to not rent to people with a bedbug history. So that increases the stigma, increases the potential risk of revealing that you have a bedbug infestation.
I read that Baltimore had one of the first city codes to mandate rat-proofing all homes. True?
That's right. Back in the 1930s, and it didn't happen.
Well, what would that consist of? What would rat-proofing a home mean?
So it means shoring up the foundation, maybe putting some wire meshes around the foundation to make it more difficult for rats to bury into the foundation and chew through. They have very strong teeth to chew through the material of the foundation of the house. That also means using garbage cans that are rat-proof. I've seen these pictures of porches that were lined with mesh in order to keep rats out from under the porches, which they could then chew apart. They're quite destructive creatures. So that was all supposed to happen back in the 1930s. And the city attempted to enforce that code along with other new housing code provisions in the 40s and 50s. They just ran out of money to do it. And that's really, I think, the biggest part of the story of public health and affordable housing and pest control is that we seem to just always run out of money and we don't do a very good job of managing the environment.
Is that ordinance still in the books?
I believe so.
We need to take a quick break here. Dawn Beeler is an associate professor of geography and environmental systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She studies urban pests. I'm Sheila Cast. This is On the Record. When we come back, we'll talk about one pest Dawn Beeler has recently zeroed in on, the mosquito. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about the creepy crawlies, urban pests like bedbugs, flies, roaches, and rats. My guest is Dawn Beeler, an associate professor of geography and environmental systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She's the author of Pests in the City: Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches, and Rats. And recently, she has turned her sight on another familiar pest. You've been studying the mosquito ecology in Baltimore.
That's right.
Tell us about that project.
So I'm working with a group of ecologists and citizen science scholars and an environmental justice scholar to try to understand how different sorts of housing conditions and socioeconomic conditions may favor mosquitoes in Baltimore. We actually started looking in Washington, D.C., which tends to have a booming housing market right now. And we wanted to see what are things like in a city that has a housing market that's been on the decline lately. And Baltimore was a very fitting example of that. We're also part of the Baltimore Ecosystem Study, which has a really well-established research infrastructure in Baltimore. So what we do is we look at a number of neighborhoods all in West Baltimore that have a range of different histories when it comes to housing disinvestment. And what I mean by that is neighborhoods that have lost funding or lost support from banks and so on through processes like redlining in history. So we look at one neighborhood that has no history of redlining at all, and then several that do have varied histories of redlining, one neighborhood among those that has a little bit of gentrification going on as well. And we try to see, well, how do these different features of the housing environment, as well as sanitation in these neighborhoods, relate to how many mosquitoes we find? And we try to ask the question, well, where are these mosquitoes breeding? Where are they coming from?
And before I ask you about your findings, tell me a bit about the team. I've read that you, in other interviews, have referred to lay ecology.
Yeah, so we try to involve community members in studying the mosquitoes there. And when I say lay ecology, I mean the way that regular folks who don't have a degree in ecology understand the environment around them. And so I do a lot of interviews with people from the neighborhood to find out where they think the mosquitoes are coming from. And one of the really interesting things that we've gotten keyed into because of these interviews is that people are always talking about the vegetation. These are neighborhoods that have lots of vacant lots. Sometimes up to a third of the housing stock is abandoned, and many of those abandoned lots actually become vacant with no home on them. So you have, in many cases, a lot of vegetation growing there. And people always say the mosquitoes are coming from those vacant lots. We know that mosquitoes come from standing water, that they breed in standing water. But my team has become more and more interested in the ways this knowledge about where mosquitoes are coming from actually cues us into the way mosquitoes move around the environment and where they rest, for example, where the male mosquitoes might be located, because male mosquitoes aren't seeking out blood meals. They get other sources of food. So we're very interested in what the people in the community can tell us about mosquitoes. We even give people these kits to go out and find mosquitoes in the environment. They pick a particular spot on their block or in their backyard, and maybe three times a summer, they complete a series of activities, and they mail us any samples of mosquitoes that they find.
That's Dawn Beeler here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. She's a professor at UMBC and an expert on household pests and how human beings have tried to control them. And she's the author of Pests in the City: Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches, and Rats. Many of us don't think of mosquitoes as being more prevalent in one part of the city than another, but you have found they actually are.
Yes. So I mentioned that we do our surveys in one neighborhood that has no history of disinvestment or redlining, and then a number of neighborhoods that do have that history of disinvestment. And those neighborhoods tend to have a large number of vacant lots, up to a third of the housing stock being vacant. And those neighborhoods that have that history of disinvestment and lots of vacant lots have about three times as many of a particular kind of mosquito as the neighborhood that has no history of disinvestment. We see particularly a lot of Aedes albopictus, which is known as the tiger mosquito. We see a lot of those guys, and that's the mosquito that we see three times more of in the neighborhoods with a history of disinvestment.
What sort of opportunities do poorer neighborhoods present for mosquitoes?
Well, there are a couple of things. There are a lot of abandoned buildings, and inside those abandoned buildings, you often have an actual a roof that's collapsed, and anything that's inside that building that can collect water will potentially breed mosquitoes. Another thing that I see going on in the lower income neighborhoods that have a history of disinvestment, you might find a block that has a row of abandoned buildings. And I see very frequently big piles of garbage in the backyards of those buildings. And what we believe is happening is that there are small-time trash haulers that pick up a load and in the middle of the night dump it in these backyards. And so we see these very large piles of trash. And
they're doing this to avoid
Tipping fees, yeah.
At a landfill.
Right. And so it could be as small as a bottle cap that collects water can breed mosquitoes. And this Aedes albopictus, and really anything in the genus Aedes, which are known for spreading a number of different diseases to humans as well as animals, they are very good at colonizing these small water bodies very quickly.
You did an experiment removing garbage from a particular area and then testing for mosquito abundance. What did that find?
So we followed adult mosquito abundances following that trash removal experiment. The preliminary numbers suggest that actually it did not reduce mosquito abundances and may have actually increased them.
And how could that be?
It's possible we chose blocks that had very high abundances of mosquitoes before the experiment. So it's possible that, and these are blocks that had high numbers of abandoned buildings, and it's possible that most of the mosquitoes were actually coming not from the trash, but from the abandoned buildings. My team doesn't go inside those abandoned buildings because it's very dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have any counts of how many mosquitoes are breeding in there. We have counts for garbage piles and flower pots, things like that, from outside of those buildings, but we just don't know what's going on inside. And so one of my suspicions is that's where they came from, on those blocks where we removed the garbage. Another possibility, and this is maybe a bit fanciful, is that a lot of people on those blocks prefer to hang out on their front porches instead of on the back. And the back is where the garbage is. The front is the neat area, a much more desirable place to hang out. So when 15 ecologists and grad students and undergrads doing this trash removal project came in, the mosquitoes got to suck our blood, and they didn't get a whole lot of human blood before that. So it's possible we actually fed this mosquito population.
I hadn't thought of that. I just want to underscore something you sort of implied. Does it follow that residents of poorer neighborhoods are at greater risk for mosquito-borne diseases?
So that's a really great question, and I think it's one that we still need some more research on. In addition to sampling mosquitoes and doing interviews with people about mosquitoes and asking people to send in, you know, samples of mosquitoes from their own backyards, we also ask people, where do you tend to spend your time and where do you get bitten by mosquitoes? And in the lower income neighborhoods, people tend to, as I said, sit on the front porch. And the mosquitoes tend to be out back. In the more affluent neighborhoods, people are often in their garden. And even though there are fewer mosquitoes there, people are getting bitten by them more, potentially, because they're out in their gardens. So we're really not sure yet what the difference in the risk is. We also know that in poorer neighborhoods, we find when we go into a mosquito and find out whose blood is inside of them, we see more cat blood or rat blood than human blood. And we think that's because people are spending their time out on the front porches, not where they would get bitten by mosquitoes, which is kind of the smart thing to do, actually.
So if you have a pile of garbage in the backyard, that may be attracting rats, which serve as meals for the mosquitoes.
Yeah.
And kind of deflect them from people.
Yeah.
And the diseases that we'd be worried about?
So West Nile virus is one disease, though it's more associated with a different species of mosquito. Some of the other diseases that we might be worried about, particularly in the future, might be, well, Zika, chikungunya, and dengue, all of which are spread by mosquitoes of the genus Aedes. And those are the kinds of mosquitoes that are associated with people, and many species of the Aedes genus are really good at coming into a human space and taking advantage of human-created containers, like everything from a bottle cap to a refrigerator crisper drawer. We see a lot of those where you've had these big dumps of appliances and furniture and so on. Now, we don't have reports of mosquito-borne Zika from last summer. There are certainly sexual cases through sexual contact, but we don't know that we had any mosquito-borne cases. Part of that has to do with how warm the year is. If we have warmer and warmer summers, mosquitoes have a better chance of building up a big population, and therefore you have more mosquitoes flying around, more of a chance of picking up Zika from a person and transmitting it to somebody else. So we'll see in the future, as potentially our summers get warmer with climate change trends.
Is there anything short of bringing these neighborhoods up to the building standards of the rest of the city that would reduce these pests?
I honestly think that we need to be investing more in making neighborhoods with lots of abandoned buildings safer, healthier places to live. Having done this garbage removal project and seeing that it doesn't get rid of all of the mosquitoes and might actually have very little effect leads me to even stronger conviction that we need to help either rebuild these homes or help communities bring them down as communities wish to help make these neighborhoods more healthy.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Don Beeler is an associate professor of geography and environmental systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She's the author of Pests in the City: Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches, and Rats. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for being with us. Come back tomorrow.